Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner and Elliot Williams.
May it please the court, Mr. John C. Steinberger will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, petitioner is requesting this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the trial court's summary judgment. The appeal here is based on the fact that we believe that the Court of Appeals misapplied the Restatement Second of Torts, Section 414, in holding that there was a fact question in this case. The contract provisions that we have in this case are rather unique, but probably not so unique when you deal with a United States government contracting entity such as the Air Force Exchange. The contract was for the benefit of the Air Force Exchange. It was a strong contract. It has provisions which hold Elliot Williams, which entered into the contract with the Air Force Exchange, holds them responsible. But the Court of Appeals has equated responsibility with control. And I think that's their basic error, is the fact that those two, at least in my mind, are not the same. The idea was to protect the Air Force Exchange under all circumstances. And in this case, in this court, in the trial court, in the Court of Appeals, petitioner has taken the position that it was always, it's still responsible to the Air Force Exchange. If the refrigerator were not installed properly, if something went wrong, it was responsible, the petitioner was responsible. What? Not to the third parties, but to the Air Force Exchange. This contract was not made for the benefit, nor does it really lend itself to a determination that there should be a responsibility on the part of Elliot Williams as a contractor when we have an independent contractor. And for that reason, actually, it should not be allowed to go forward. There's no duty. And that's one of the things that the Court of Appeals first said. Well, it's our determination. Is there a duty? What is the duty of Elliot Williams? All the duties that are spelled out in the contract are spelled out in favor of the Air Force Exchange. It goes not only to the Air Force Exchange, it goes to its customers, it's spelled out to its representatives. Not one place in that contract does it say anything about third parties, and in this particular instance, of course, we have an injury by an individual who was working for another subcontractor on the job. There's nothing said anywhere in the contract, but the Court of Appeals has determined if Elliot Williams is responsible for the action of Wingard, then we must apply the restatement of torts and say, were you responsible? If you're responsible, that means that you have the control. And did you exercise reasonable control? That's not the test that this court has set forth, as I determined. And the problem is we have a determination that really opens up an independent contractor status is going to be questioned in every case. If parties enter into a contract where they're not in, let's say in Redinger and some of the other cases that we've looked at, they actually had provisions in there that we were going to have OSHA. You need to protect against OSHA. You need to obey the various statutes. There's not anything like that in this contract. What this is a contract between two parties, and it is for the benefit of the Air Force Exchange. And looking particularly at the provisions that talk about indemnity, assignment, and some of the things that the appellee is basing their defense on. It says the contractor will indemnify, hold harmless, and defend the Air Force Exchange and all other agencies and instrumentalities of the United States, etc., from loss, damage, alleged or established to arisen out or in connection with items of service provided by the contractor, unless that damage was caused by the Air Force Exchange. Goes on that any loss, damage, or injury alleged or established to have arisen out of or in connection with any other acts or omissions of the contractor. It talks about assignment, and it says the contractor may not assign its rights or delegate its obligations. Elliott Williams did not assign its rights. It did not attempt to say, Lingle, you're going to be responsible for the Air Force Exchange. What it did is it contracted with Mr. Lingle. The affidavit showed the method of the contract, the way the terms were, who was supposed to do what. There was not any operational control. There was not anything called for. It also says that the contractor is fully responsible for the actions of all employees and contracted representatives. If responsibility, and that is liability, to the individuals, or rather to the Air Force Exchange, if that is going to be construed to be the same as to say, well, if you're responsible, therefore it means you have control. And therefore we have to make the second test to go down, did you exercise that control reasonably? Did you look and was that control exercised over the given area that caused this accident? Which generally you're not responsible for an independent contractor. The only place, and this goes on to a section 19 of the attached contract, talks about contractor liability, and this is something that the appellee has fastened on, but it talks about an injury to person or property proximately caused by action or inaction attributable to the contractor. But that only comes into play if, in fact, Elliott Williams was in default under the contract. And even then, that's pretty broad language. So really what this case comes down to is the fact that this contract has only one basis. It has a responsibility. And as I say, if you're going to equate responsibility with control, then Elliott Williams is going to be responsible to Mr. Diaz. But that's not what this contract is about.
Mr. Steinberger, I understand. Well, if I own some property and I'm fixing to have some work done on it, and I hire a contractor to come in and do the work, and I assign to the contractor the duty to maintain a safe workplace, and the contractor says, I undertake that obligation, unless the contractor actually complies with the contract and undertakes the activities of maintaining a safe place to work, you don't see under any circumstance that the contractor would be liable for injuries to a subcontractor's employee because of an unsafe place to work.
Well, Your Honor, when we talk about an unsafe place to work, if you had, that goes back to some of the restatement of courts and the commentaries, that if you have control over the area, if you have responsibility under the terms of the contract for safety, then you would have some responsibility.
So it is your argument is just, if you look at this contract, it didn't assign to Elliott Williams any particular duty that the subcontractor's employee is arguing was breached.
That's right. It just comes down to the fact that if we're going to, if this test here is allowed to stand, that okay, if responsibility means that then you do have control and we need to check on down and see what kind of control you exerted, if that's going to be the test, then it seems to me that nearly every contract that you're going to have with an independent contractor status in it is going to have to be tested, and it's going to have to be tested factually. What it comes down here is there's no dispute as to the way these, both as to the terms of the contract and the manner of fulfilling the contract.
So that I'm clear, that if this contract had explicitly required Elliott Williams to be responsible for a safe workplace, there'd arguably have been a duty established in this case, and then the only question is whether it was breach of that duty.
Yes, sir.
But because the contract doesn't explicitly do that, the general just going to be responsible for the activities out there doesn't create the duty.
I don't believe it does. I believe the responsibility that it's speaking to, and perhaps I just don't see the problem, but it, to me, it's speaking to a responsibility to the Air Force Exchange. It's a responsibility to indemnify the Air Force Exchange. If the Air Force Exchange were sued by the Mr. Diaz, they would have had to been indemnified. If there had been found any responsibility, Elliott Williams would have had to indemnify them under the terms of the contract, because they are responsible to the Air Force Exchange.
So if the contract, let's suppose the contract was different and it said that Elliott Williams shall supervise and control the activities of all of its representatives and independent contractors. And if they didn't do that, they would be in breach of their contract with the Air Force, but would they be responsible or liable to Mr. Diaz?
Well, Your Honor, under the cases as this court's been deciding, I think they could be. But that's not the case here. I mean, that's what we've run into, and that's what it appears to me this court's been delineating in the past years, is this status of an independent contractor and requiring, as a part of the commentary and that restatement of torts, that there must be some type of provision in the contract, and then that provision in supervising on that basis must be done in a reasonable manner.
But in the example I just gave you, if Elliott Williams did not comport with the contract, if they did not indeed supervise and control the independent contractor, you think that there would be liability perhaps to Diaz, just because they have a contract with the Air Force?
Well, I mean, we're talking about, I mean, it comes down, of course, we've got a tort basis and a contract basis for liability, and of course here we're looking at the tort basis, and under the tort law, the court has allowed to look to that contract. I mean, I guess I'm more of a strict interpreter of contracts, and I have some strong doubts about how you look to a contract for the benefit of an individual who's not mentioned in it. But that's not really the point. The court has applied this restatement of torts and has then set forth the various limitations on it, and for that reason, under your circumstance, it seems to me, yes, there could possibly be liability. But it's not there in this case. And I think in cases of this matter, and one of the problems is when you're contracting, just as a practical matter, particularly with the government, you don't have any choice at all as to what's going to be done. Now, sure, you go in with your eyes open, but nevertheless, you have no choice as to what the terms of that contract are going to be. But here, the government protects itself. And if it's going to be particular about protecting everybody, it could have spelled that out too, and it didn't. No further questions.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Edward W. Dunbar will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, my name is Edward Dunbar. Paso, and I represent Manuel and Irma Diaz. This is a summary judgment case. I am mindful, as are my clients, that during recent years this court has decided a series of vicarious liability cases which have turned on the degree of control retained by the principal, whether it's the occupier of the premises, the landlord, the owner, the general contractor, in a variety of settings. Recently, beginning with Exxon versus Tidwell and continuing, in my reading at least, through Reed versus Scott, Fetzer, a number of theories have been applied, and counsel opposite touched upon that briefly, to quote a previous justice on this court, that a hybrid of law has developed in this regard. and taking agency theories, taking landlord-tenant theories, premises defects, and really the general law of torts, most notably Section 414 of the restatement, which was alluded to in the previous presentation. There is, while it may not be homes in its scope, there has been a bright line, I feel, that's been drawn in this. And if were it not for this contract, I think my client would be outside of that line and would not be able to prevail against
Mr. Dunbar, when you say that, can we construe that as an agreement that this is a duty case? And
yes,
the question
sir.
Is whether this particular contract furnishes the duty that gives rise to tort liability.
I would agree with that.
And
assessment.
We don't have a case of actual control here.
I believe there should have been actual control, and it goes back to the contract.
Well, that's what I mean. But I don't get from your briefs or what's in there on the facts that as between Elliot Williams and Lingle, or Elliot Williams and James, who's also another contractor involved, that Elliot Williams exercised actual control on the installation of the cooler freezer.
Well, as the restatement teaches and the case law teaches, it's the right to exercise control.
I understand, and that's what I'm getting to. All that we're looking at here is the contract as the basis for furnishing the duty.
Yes, sir.
And whether they did anything or not, they've got a contractual control right, in your view, which gives rise to tort liability.
I would agree with that assessment again, sir.
Mr. Dunbar, in that regard, in the cases that we've looked at, it seems that the contract on control retention really is with respect to the contractor and the subcontractor, or the actual control exercise between the contractor and subcontractor. Do you have any cases out there where the contract is between the contractor and the premises owner and not with the subcontractor who brings employee on the grounds?
I'm trying to remember some of the previous cases where there would have been the actual owner. I'm not sure if the Clayton Williams case had an ownership interest, but he certainly was the occupier. That company had the whole oil rig, and it was there, so you probably had
that. That was a question of control. In
yes,
Exxon
sir.
Versus Tidwell, that was a question of contract, and in Fetzer, it was really a control issue on who retained the right to control or who was dictating control. Seems to me your case is where you're saying, well, Elliot Williams had an agreement with someone upstream about what their responsibility would be, but it had nothing to do with Lingle. It had nothing. This was not an agreement of Elliot Williams to control what Lingle was doing.
And that is why I view Lingle as, while he may be called a subcontractor, whatever label you put on him, Elliot Williams was still responsible for his actions because of this. And if nothing else is remembered from my presentation, I would hope that this is. The paragraph or Article 8 dealing with assignment clearly states that the contractor cannot assign its rights or delegate its duties, its obligations under this contract. This was a contract where Elliot Williams was to do the job, and it was not to be delegated. That's why the control's still there. That's why the control never left, in our estimation.
Why isn't that just to the owner's benefit?
It was the owner's benefit, but we're still talking about the right to control, and I don't think that wiped that out. Certainly, if there was a breach of the contract in the performance and Lingle did something wrong, the owner could sue both of them. But by assignment, and again, the restatements are just woven through this, that to assign an obligation without getting permission or having a novation of some sort with the upstream owner, in this case the exchange service, then the obligor is still obligated under the contract, and that's our whole view of the control issue. And it turns primarily on the obligations that you were to perform and that you could not delegate. And in the discovery process, what little was done in this case, it was established that they could have asked, Elliott Williams could have asked, did not ask, and so no permission was sought or ever received. They remained in control of the project.
If the contract had not said fully responsible, if it had been an indemnification provision, that Elliott Williams indemnified AAFES for all actions that might occur on the project, would your position still be the same?
No. The assignment clause, representative clause, which is Article 9, that contractor is fully responsible for the actions of all employees and contracted representatives, which I think the appellate court was correct in including legal within that phrase. It's these other provisions that are controlling. If it just was a indemnification agreement, I don't think we'd have much. And we certainly, I don't think we'd be here. But there's been an attempt throughout this to categorize these other requirements and obligations of Elliott Williams as part of some sort of indemnity agreement or part of the indemnity. The indemnity is up in Article, I believe, 7, and these other, the assignment article, the representatives article, and then the one that was mentioned by counsel opposite, the contractor liability, that states, in addition to everything else, that Elliott Williams will be responsible for consequential damages for the injury to person or property approximately caused by action or inaction attributable to the contractor. Taken as a whole, these documents tied, or these provisions in the document, tied Elliott Williams to performing its obligations itself, which it could have easily had delegated had it only asked, but it did not. It remained in control.
Is there evidence in the record that this contract went to the subcontractors? And if so, then it also went to their employees, generally posted?
The evidence of how this went to Lingle is really within the affidavits only of the Elliott Williams representatives. There is a contract that was signed in 1986 that's one of the exhibits to the summary judgment proof. It's called it's an independent representative agreement that's primarily directed at sales. And it then speaks to if there is a separate installation, that will be handled differently. I'm not entirely sure, and I don't think the lower court was either, that agreement between Elliott Williams and Lingle for sales really was the agreement whereby Lingle undertook to do, was employed, if you will, by Elliott Williams. So they could not rid themselves of the obligation they'd undertaken. Now, in the brief by Elliott Williams, there is an attempt to categorize this as, well, it wasn't a non-delegable duty, and then they go into the common law of delegable duties, which deal with non-delegable duties if it's an artistic performance or it's based on a personal relationship, or you've hired a specific person to do a job for some personal reason. None of that is...
Mr. Dunbar, you agree that this contract is between AAFES and Elliott Williams.
Yes, ma'am.
And that the obligations in the responsibility clause that you're talking about flow from Elliott Williams to AAFES.
Yes.
Then how do you make the next step that those obligations between two parties to a contract, in fact, inure to the benefit of the rest of the world?
It inures to the benefit just the same way that other persons who were injured as a result of an upstream relationship, for example, in the Kirby vacuum cleaner case and other cases, you always are going to have someone that is injured that's not a party to the contract. I mean, that happens in construction sites.
This seems that these obligations are flowing the wrong direction for your client to be able to benefit from them.
Not when viewed, I don't respectfully, not when viewed in the context of control, that this kept Elliot Williams in control of the premises.
Made him responsible for what happened, but did it actually give control over how work was to be performed at the job site?
By not, this is why I think the delegation and assignment clause is so important. Unless they received, Elliot Williams received, permission to assign, then they remained in control.
No, but you're talking about control. The clause is written in terms of responsibility.
Yes.
And aren't those
yes.
two different words with two different meanings?
I think if you undertake...
I am responsible for what happens to AAFES. It doesn't matter whether I have control over anything or not. I'm going to be responsible as to AAFES. How does that language translate into a control obligation in the contract as to other people?
I would argue that if one is obligated to perform a service that it cannot delegate, then it, by definition, has to control the site to make sure the work is done. But it's responsible. It has a duty to provide a safe working environment for business invitees such as Mr. Diaz.
Well, it seems like under your argument, you're saying that that the general contractor was supposed to do all the work and it really couldn't even hire subcontractors to do the work. Because that would be a delegation under your reading.
All Elliot Williams had to do was to ask and receive permission to do this.
No, but my point is, short of getting that permission, it's your position that they were not permitted to subcontract out work under this agreement.
They were obligated to do it themselves.
Yes, at several junctures in the contract itself, it explicitly contemplates and refers to subcontractors.
I would state that the non-delegable clause would control, and that, again, this was not a general contractor that was going to erect the whole Army Air Force Exchange, post-exchange unit. This was to place a rather large 34 by 13 by 8 feet walk-in freezer within a portion of it that Elliot Williams did have control over and could have exercised its control rights.
But yes, sir, you do concede that the contract specifically contemplates that Elliot Williams will have subcontractors and tells it to do specific things with regard to those subcontractors.
And to that extent, I would say that because they could have received permission to do it, I think then there's a reference to that that would not be an unusual thing for them to do.
Mr. Dunbar, even with the provision that if they got permission from AAFES to use someone else to install the refrigerator, why, again, does that contractual obligation inure to the benefit of your client?
Because it required Elliot Williams to perform the work, and if they could not delegate, they were to perform the work in a safe manner for business invitees. I mean, the duty flows from, I mean, duty, responsibility, I mean, they were supposed to do it, and no one else was under the terms of the contract.
As to their contract with AAFES?
Yes. Just as in other upstream, when you have an agreement that flows upstream from a company or a sales organization or what have you, the person that's usually hurt is not a part. I mean, that's what the whole body of law is about, that you're going to have an injured party that wasn't a party to the contract. And that's why in reviewing this case, the idea of third-party beneficiary is so inapplicable, that it doesn't have anything to do with this. There's enough bodies of law that are relevant to this area, such as agency and premises defects, that is one I don't believe has any place here. But that's the same idea. How can someone who's injured be receive any protection under this? Well, the answer is because the contractor was obligated to perform, provide a safe place for everyone.
Leaving the contracts aside, who do you think had the best ability to ensure safety in this particular situation?
I would say Elliot Williams had the best ability to do that because, and again, I commend the very brief 1986 agreement between Elliot Williams and Lingle. Elliot Williams clearly was the one running the show here. They had the control over it. Now, on the ground, on the day that happened, legal was there. And if your question is leading up in the specific, you know, circumstances of that day when the accident occurred, who was in the best position to do it? It clearly would have been legal. But Elliott Williams retained control throughout this whole process and could have and should have seen to it that you didn't stack unsupported freezer panels in a manner where they would domino and fall.
So you're saying that's the consequence regardless of the contract with Avis?
No, I'm sorry, without the contract?
Right.
Oh, without the contract, I think you would have just a regular independent contractor, general contractor, if you will, relationship, and we would not have a contract.
So, Mr. Dunbar, excuse me. You said in answer to the question that Elliott Williams had control of the area where this large 34 by so forth. But that's different than what you said at the outset of the argument, that they had no actual control over the area where the...
If I said they didn't have control, then I don't recall was wrong.
But still, in what I'm trying to find out, a statement that they had actual control of the area where this was installed is not the same as your argument that they had control because the contract required them to have control, which is what you said at the first. That the whole basis of why Elliott Williams is liable in this case is the contract.
Yes, which gave them
no liability based on regular premises liability on control.
I think you'd have a traditional case.
And you also said that you're very clear in your mind that the third-party beneficiary theory does not apply in this case.
I do not believe it does. If it were to be applied, I think we would be, an intended, as a restatement now calls it, an intended beneficiary. You don't have to be called by name. Or under, I guess, the old rubric, it would be a donee beneficiary. I didn't understand those years ago, and I'm not sure I do now. But I think an argument could be made. While the theory does not apply, if it were to be applied, I think it would be.
Mr. Dunbar, you mentioned in talking about the contract Elliott Williams had an obligation under the contract to maintain a safe workplace. What provision of the contract are you referring to?
The contract does not speak to safety, but I think there is, if you undertake to do a job, you must undertake, and there are business invitees to be on the premises, you have a duty to do it safely.
But this is a contract for the provision of merchandise, supplies, and equipment, not a construction contract.
Which were to be installed. No. The work order, which is also part of the summary judgment proof, speaks to, and I'm not sure if I got this exactly right, delivery, storage, installation, and something else. So Elliott Williams, when they signed that, they did have to place it, put it together,
right,
assemble it.
But they were basically selling equipment, sort of equipment that they were going to install.
Install.
Right. And there's no provision in this contract, and given the kind of contract it is, that they were to maintain a safe work environment for business invitees.
I think that's not implied. I think that is a duty that's enforced by the law. That if you undertake to do a job on a site that you have control and you're just the same as a landlord or whatever, that you've got to do it in a safe manner. I think what you may be getting at is if this were a case with in a more traditional setting, if you didn't have, you would have to have that specific relation to safety and security, such as you saw in Tidwell and some of the other.
Well, no, what I'm getting at is the fact that you said they had a non-delegable duty to maintain a safe work environment that the location was safe for other business invitees that came in, and
yes,
they couldn't delegate that duty. And I'm just trying to figure out where that comes from, and whether or not you were relying on a particular provision of the contract.
Both the contracts are notable for their lack of mention of safety, but that is a duty imposed by the law.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
the particular provision about the assignment, there is no attempt to assign any of the duties of Elliott Williams to the Air Force Exchange by having Lingle make this installation. Elliott Williams still remained responsible to the Air Force Exchange. And had, as I say, had there been any claim against the Air Force Exchange, the indemnity provisions would have come in. If they wanted to make an assignment, the purpose of making an assignment would be then not to have that responsibility, because Air Force Exchange then would be looking to the one that the assignment had been taken out. Elliott Williams remained responsible, liable, for the failure of Lingle to, if the installation was not made properly, it remained that way. If had they made an assignment, then they might not have, because then the one who was the assignment was made to would take on that responsibility with the consent of the Air Force Exchange. The Air Force Exchange was interested in having that refrigerator installed properly, and that's what Elliott Williams' responsibility was. As far as, you know, the suit was also brought against the general contractor in this case, the same allegations that under Redinger and the others, that they had an on-site representative. But that case was dismissed.
James was the general contractor?
Yes, sir. So, and I admit, and by throwing in this third-party beneficiary, I suppose, I mean, I know we're dealing with tort law, but it seemed to me that there has to be some test here other than what the Court of Appeals has done, because just to use the term responsibility, and then, as I say, to me they've equated that with control, that just opens it up. And
well, I think Mr. Dunbar saved you that problem by saying the theory doesn't apply, so
yes, sir.
A little excess briefing doesn't hurt, though, I guess.
But I think, I mean, this is what it comes down to. There's just simply no duty in this case on the part of Elliott Williams.
Yeah. Thank you. That concludes the arguments in today's call. Marshall will please adjourn the panel.